Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So tonight is the observance night, the half moon, the waxing moon. The moon is getting bigger, or that's how it appears anyway, February. And almost halfway through the winter retreat time. It's rather an alarming thought, isn't it? Seems as though we've hardly begun this opportunity that we all have to focus more exclusively on the meditation practice, cultivating the formal meditation practice, contemplating the teachings, and actually seeing, examining more closely how they work within our own minds and bodies. And for some of us, we've had the opportunity to hear Ajahn Chah's teachings on meditation. Ajahn Amaro has been giving readings almost every evening. And that's been very nourishing, very enriching as well. At least that's what I found. Just hearing, getting a sense of Ajahn Chah's way of teaching, way of encouraging, and the word encouraging is really a bit too soft. it's sometimes even more vigorous than encouraging. It's really pushing people to look and to practice and to go against the habits of the mind. To really put forth effort into investigating and testing ourselves out in quite explicit ways. And I found that very, very helpful. Because there is this tendency to become rather complacent. A few weeks, months ago, a lot of talk about complacency, and I always, when I heard this, I thought, that's not me, I'm not complacent. It doesn't apply to me. And then just realizing that, living this life year after year, following the routines, that one can become a bit complacent, a bit relaxed with it all. And that sometimes it's really helpful to have some more kind of vigorous, forceful encouragement, from somebody who really knows what they're talking about. It's one of the things, one of the impressions one gets from listening to the teachings of Ajahn Chah is just a sense that he's really talking with authority. He's experienced, his experience of practice and seeing the results of practice. It gives it makes a particular kind of impact when we hear it like that. So in some ways this time of practice is an opportunity for us to really apply the teachings very vigorously, very, very, very diligently, in our own practice, examining our own minds and bodies, and the way that we cause suffering for ourselves, and to experience the cessation of suffering also within our hearts, in order that we too can become an authority. Can speak with confidence about the way that these teachings actually work, are actually relevant within our own lives. It's not just a nice idea or something that we kind of believe that they might be true, but we can speak with authority. We know that if we practice in this way, that there will be these results. Very much appreciate the structure that we have on this retreat, and I'm glad that there's been opportunities for practicing together as a group, and also I've been very enjoying the fact that the more senior members of the community have had a chance to develop their own practice in a more solitary way. And there's something very lovely about the sense that all of these different styles of practice can be accommodated, and the sense that everyone benefits. And it's interesting that we're just about to begin a time of much less structure. So for all of us, there'll be a chance to experiment a little bit. And I notice myself, if I know that I have to get up, or if I know that there's going to be a morning sit here in the temple, I tend to be a little bit more cautious about how late I sit, or the extent to which I extend the practice into the evening, into the night. And so now we have a chance to not have to worry about having to get up early or anything else. We can experiment, try out, sitting up really late if we feel like it, or even if we don't feel like it, just see what happens. Just do it for the heck of it, or getting up really early, just sort of not being worried about whether it's 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. It doesn't matter. If we find that we're really tired and all over the place, then we can have a rest. So it's really lovely to have this chance for everybody to experiment a bit, find out, what kind of style works for you. For each one of us to find out what kind of style of practice works best, whether we're night people or early morning people, or whether it's all wonderful, all delicious, or whether it's all hard. And my sense is that probably what we'll find is that all of it is sometimes hard and sometimes wonderful. And that's really the way the practice goes. I didn't have many opportunities to meet Ajahn Chah, but on one occasion at Chithurst, he came and stayed at Chithurst for the very first week that the community were there. And I was a layperson at the time, and I decided to go and just help the monastic community to get settled there, to help the monks get the place in some kind of shape. And I had taken some time off work, and I was there for about 10 days. And I actually arrived on the very first day that they moved in, where the place was still absolutely full of rubbish. And they were having this bonfire out in the front driveway, burning all kinds of odds and ends that they found around the house, bits of furniture that wasn't going to be useful. And I remember one time, the very first day I arrived, we all brought kind of mops and buckets and things to help clean up the place. And I remember getting into the kitchen and cleaning a whole load of shelves. I'd never seen such dirt in my whole life. It's absolutely revolting. The people who'd lived there before, they hadn't really known about cleaning or about throwing things out. The house was absolutely full of stuff. And I remember cleaning these shelves, putting a lot of effort into cleaning these shelves. And then, I don't know if it was later that day or the next day, seeing the Anagarikas, including Venerable Vajira, who was an Anagarika at the time, ripping the shelves off the wall and putting them on the bonfire. So it was a good lesson in letting go and just doing the work for the enjoyment of the work and not worrying about whether the fruits of one's efforts landed up on the bonfire or not. It was still good to do. Anyway, during the first week that we were there, at that time, in fact, the women were, we were living up in the attic, so there wasn't a sort of sense of a very clear division about where people stayed. The lay women, we all had the rooms in the attic at the very beginning, and the monks were kind of on the middle floor in the sort of big rooms, and so we slept at the top, and so we got down the stairs. And I remember one time, one of the Anagarikas, it was Jordan actually, who later became Venerable Sumano, who asked if I would like to take a tray of tea up for Lumpur Cha. And it was a very, very thoughtful, because there was no way I would have done it on my own without that encouragement. So I went up and went into this room, and it was candlelight, and Lumpur Cha was sitting on the bed, and there was Kitty Saru and Babakaro and I think Ajahn V were all sitting there, and there was this incredible sense of presence. And I didn't speak Thai, obviously, so Ajahn Chah, he addressed me. He said, how's your practice going? That was how it was translated. And the only answer that came to mind was, it changes. And he then gave a teaching on change, how everything changes, everything is unreliable, can't rely on anything. And I think this is a very helpful thing for us to keep in mind during this retreat time, is the fact that it does change, and that there'll be some times that we sit down and the mind settles very easily, and very calm, peaceful meditation. And there'll be other times when we sit down and we seem to be doing exactly the same thing, and mind just doesn't settle at all. A lot of memories or a lot of ideas or planning, or we might find ourselves feeling really resentful about something, or feel that we've had a raw deal. You know, why do I have to do this and she has to do that, and you know, why can't I do this, or how come he's got that and I didn't get any? Or why do we have to do it like this? Or ideas about the monastery, you know, how things should be. And one of the things that can happen on retreat, as you might have noticed, is that the mind can become really obsessed. The obsessions seem to really take hold. And we can find ourselves with a lot of thinking or planning or feeling righteous about the things that aren't okay. And we can feel that our meditation is just a complete disaster, you know, because the mind is just full of all this stuff. And it's quite important that how we respond to this, because it will be a disaster if we start contending with it all, and if we start fighting with ourselves, feeling that we shouldn't have all of these thoughts. And I think one of the things that has been very revealing for people, sort of through the readings and the discussions that have come afterwards, is the fact that thinking is normal in meditation. You know, you sit down to meditate and the mind is going to think until there's a sense of calm, until there's a sense of settledness. So we don't actually have to fight with our thoughts. We don't have to go to war with the mind. But more to learn how to work with it, how to respond skillfully to the thoughts, the ideas, the planning, the obsessions. If we approach these intruders, let's call them intruders, these visitors, with a lot of ill will, a lot of aversion, the chances are they're going to be a bit rebellious, a bit resistant, and they might well fight back. Or they might just stubbornly stay. You know, if we're in a situation and we have a feeling that someone's trying to push us out or get rid of us, you know, it can bring up a tremendous sort of sense of stubbornness. No, I'm not going to stay. I don't care what you think. I'm not going to stay. I'm not going to go. Sorry, I'm not going to go. Whereas if we feel accepted, and Ajahn Sumedho used to talk about embracing, which I always found a bit much. It's not always possible to quite embrace these obsessive thoughts. Well, I can't embrace them, but I can make a space for them. You're sort of okay. If you need to be here, you can stay. My heart is big enough. I can accommodate whatever wants to arise there. And creating a kind of a spaciousness around them, around whatever it is that's come to visit, then that's the way of actually allowing them to leave, you know, because we're not contending. There's a sense of allowing. It's not that we like them, it's not that we want them to be there particularly, but we don't have to feel upset or intimidated by them. And we can even play with them a bit, take an interest in whatever it might be. So thinking is not necessarily a disaster. Obsessive thinking, irritable thinking, grumpy thinking, rebellious thinking, critical, all of these kind of thoughts, they needn't be a problem. The worrying, the planning, the ideas that we have about our practice. Now, these are very insidious. You might have noticed they creep in there and they're so convincing, you know, about whether we're any good or not, whether our practice is any good, what we've got to do, whether we're ever going to manage. These are the ones that you need to be very attentive to, because they do seem quite real and correct. Yes, of course I'm hopeless. Of course I'll never be any good. Sometimes it's helpful just to disengage with an expression like, there is thinking, and just describing it in a kind of more detached, dispassionate way. Ajahn Chah, he used to say that the whole practice is about letting go. And I think for some of us, or maybe all of us, there are some times when we would just love to be able to let go, but we don't know how to. And I think sometimes we get confused between letting go and allowing to go. We think that letting go means getting rid of, rather than seeing it's more an allowing, a softening, an opening, an enabling rather than shooing things away, getting rid of them as quickly as possible. So this is why we need to be very rather patient and rather playful and rather curious, rather interested in this whole undertaking. Because it is an undertaking. We've undertaken to liberate the heart from suffering, liberate the heart from the causes of suffering, the greed, hatred, delusion, the wrong ways of thinking, the unskillful habits, the habits of thought, the habits of relating with ourselves that cause us misery. One of the greatest insights that I had was when I realized that misery is something that is created in my own heart, in my own mind. It doesn't have anything to do with what's going on around me. It's more my response to the external conditions. So nobody else is responsible for my misery. That's an interesting thought, isn't it? We're so ready to blame another person. You know, if only they didn't do that. If only we didn't have to do this. If only all the if onlys. If only it could be otherwise. I was talking to somebody the other day, saying, talking about a time when I was feeling particularly kind of irritable, and there was one person, I can't actually even remember who it was or what it was they were doing, but somebody had said something to me that I found particularly upsetting, and the thought arose in my mind, you know, if only that person wouldn't say that to me. And then I started thinking about all the other people who said things that I found annoying and difficult, and I ended up with a whole list of, if only he wouldn't say that to me, if only she wouldn't say that to me, if only he wouldn't look at me like that, if only she wouldn't do that, if only he wouldn't walk like that, if only she wouldn't eat like that. I mean, it was just went on and on and on. And I realized that I was actually sort of trying to kind of arrange the whole world, to sort of just tweak it here and there, just to fit in with what wouldn't be irritating to me. And it wasn't long before I saw how ridiculous that was. But this is what we do, isn't it? This is what we do all the time. If only it wasn't like this, if only he wasn't like this, if only she wasn't like this. So if these are thoughts that are arising, I would suggest to take a deeper look at what's really going on. Is it really that person or that thing or that situation that is the cause for the misery or the anger or the irritation, the suffering, the struggle? Or is it our feeling that things should be otherwise? Our aversion. Our negativity. Can we make a space in our heart for that thing that's wrong in the universe? Can we accommodate it as just being, this is how it is right now? Can we do that? Years ago at Chithurst, we had one of the people who came to visit us was Lumpo Panyananda, and some of you will have met him, will remember his visits here and at Chithurst. And I think one of the most remarkable things about him was just his quiet sense of ease. And we were a very kind of rough and ready community in those days. I mean, we weren't kind of particularly polished or pukka in the way that we did things. It was all slightly chaotic. But the one thing we had was enthusiasm. There was a lot of enthusiasm. And we worked very hard. And we were enthusiastic. And it was interesting because he came and he stayed with us. And there was just this sense of being completely at ease with all of us. And it was very, very pleasant to be around him, because one sensed that, you know, nothing that one could do would upset him or faze him in any way. You know, he was just kind of interested. You know, he was very interested. Apparently he used to have a radio program, or he was invited to speak on the radio, and apparently when he went back to Thailand, he talked a lot about his visit to Chithurst and what he found there. And I think he talked about our breakfast, our porridge. He was rather amazed that we could eat this porridge. And he was impressed by our kind of enthusiasm and diligence. But what was remarkable was just the sense of ease, the ability to accommodate whatever was happening around him. And obviously there are many other people who can do that. And it was just interesting to notice how comfortable it was to be around that. It wasn't something that engendered a sense of kind of sloppiness or sort of not caring, or, you know, well, he doesn't mind, therefore I won't bother. But it was more a sense of that I was okay. So I suppose what I'm working around to is just a sense of that in some way, that this, rather than trying to make the world the way we want it, and make all kinds of demands on our brothers and sisters and friends who are living with us, is a sense that the more that we actually cultivate a sense of inner ease, that in itself enables a sense of ease around us. I notice myself, I tend to do better when there is that kind of atmosphere. Of course, we have to begin with cultivating this sense of ease and friendliness towards ourselves. This sense of acceptance, this sense of appreciation and encouragement. And learning how to recognize what we need, having that a sense of discernment. So, you know, sometimes, you know, we do need to push ourselves a bit, encourage ourselves to maybe go beyond what we feel that we can manage, you know, to be a bit brave. You know, particularly during this time where, you know, there's not any particular structure that we need to follow. I mean, there's the meal. That's a kind of important part of the day, to at least, if we want to eat, to get there for the meal. But other than that, you know, it doesn't matter if we find that we're, you know, sleepy all over the place. And having, you know, got up at 2 o'clock in the morning or having sat up till 2 o'clock through the night, doesn't matter. We can enjoy the opportunity to experiment, to go beyond what we think is manageable. Not from a place of aversion or negativity or fear. You know, sometimes our practice can be driven by fear. You know, we fear that we're not good enough, we're not practicing hard enough, we fear that we're not keeping up with everybody else. Or a sense of competitiveness, you know, I'm going to be the best. But more just because we want the very best for ourselves. So it's not kind of pushing ourselves, beating ourselves, or you know, doing it in a way that's going to be harmful or full of negativity, but you know, wanting the very best. You know, come on, you can do it. This will be good for you. The Buddha said it'd be good for you. Lumbo Cha said it'd be good for you. Let's give it a go. Let's try. And then also recognizing if there are times that you really need to rest, that you take time to rest. You know, if you're getting worn out, if you're getting really grumpy, you know, this would be particularly for the lay support team, because you all have to, you know, work in the kitchen and, you know, you have duties, practical things that need to be attended to. You need to be able to work together and cooperate. So, you know, if you do find that you're getting really rattled and grumpy, then, you know, that's usually a sign that you need to take a little bit more rest. So, you know, having that kind of discernment, and maybe getting it wrong sometimes, but just experimenting. So this wide open time is a very precious time for us to experiment. If we feel that we need some company, we can come to the temple, you know, even though there aren't, you know, formal sittings, but come and sit here. It's a lovely, lovely place to come and sit quietly. Or so these are a few suggestions for the next days. It's a long time since I've allowed myself to have nothing to say for so long during a Dhamma talk. But I thought I'd just experiment a bit, see how it feels. And I thank you for bearing with me. I'd had this really of strong wish to be able to offer some reflections that would be really encouraging and uplifting and something that would be of value. And maybe that's all there is to say for now. Other than just to keep going. You know, even if it seems really difficult, even if you feel really discouraged or that things are not going the way that you would have hoped, just to keep going. And to realize that the practice is partly about meditation. That's a really important and significant part of our life. But it's also about just how we live our lives in between the times that we're sitting here in the temple. You know, just cultivating mindfulness wherever we are, whatever we're doing. Cultivating patience wherever we are, whoever we're with, whatever's going on around us. You know, are we really able to establish a sense of presence when things are unpleasant or difficult? You know, so often we think we're being patient, but actually we're waiting for something to end, which is rather different than actually just being willing to stay with whatever it is that's going on for as long as it's as long as it needs to be there. Allowing it to end, allowing it to change. And kindness, generosity, just cultivating the paramitas. I found that very helpful when, at a time when I was having trouble with my meditation, just to contemplate the idea of cultivating a bit more generosity, sila, renunciation, wisdom, discernment, energy, truthfulness, patience, determination, kindness, and equanimity. And just considering these perfections that we can be cultivating, even if our mind is totally all over the place, we can still cultivate a generous heart, we can still cultivate a kind heart, a patient heart. A heart of discernment, you know, it's able to really examine and consider, you know, look at the patterns, look at the habits of mind. Let us consider how we respond, how we react to things. You know, are these reactions, these habitual responses, are they helpful? Or might it be good to actually investigate, to consider, you know, how we could do things differently, how we could respond differently? And just actually really looking, using our own experience of life, our own patterns, our own habits, you know, working with these rather than some theoretical teaching or what somebody else has told us. You know, what are the things, what are the ways of responding that cause me suffering or cause confusion, that make me feel unhappy, glum? You know, can I respond differently? Needn't be anything terribly impressive or dramatic, earth-shaking. You know, it can just be a very simple, small thing. I remember one winter retreat at Chithurst where everybody was doing very dramatic aditanas and very spectacular practice, and practice that I decided to try to do was just to watch how I picked things up, you know, physical things, you know, whether I grabbed them or whether I just picked it up gently, and how I put them down again. I don't know where I got that idea from, but anyway, I decided to just do that. I suppose because I'd noticed that I tended to grab things and tended to throw things down. And just, you know, noticing that was actually a very helpful practice for me at that time, just learning how to deal with the material world in a gentler way, in a more mindful, more present, more respectful way. So that's something, you know, just for each one of us, there's an edge to our life, an edge to our practice, that as we relax into it and actually really kind of make friends with ourselves, soften up around ourselves, let go of some of the fear about not being good enough, or, you know, that we've got to, you know, do this or do that, and actually just relax and just actually take a look and see what are our ways, the ways that are less skillful, that are less gentle, less kind, less helpful, that we can change There's little ways that we can adjust and cultivate different habits, different ways of relating to ourselves and to each other and to the world around us. And in this way, the practice becomes our own. You know, it becomes something that we take on board. It's really ours. And we can become really interested in it, really fascinated by it. And little by little, we find that we too, you know, we become our own authority. You know, we can say, well, yes, I tried this, I noticed this. This worked, this didn't work. And in this way, we build up confidence. So these are just a few suggestions and encouragements for everybody. And I wish everyone a very enjoyable and fruitful and energetic and enthusiastic life. Anyone?